Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of MedTech Trends. I'm your host, Dorian. So today we have with us a very special guest. He's the executive chairman of Open Orphan, and he's joining us from London, I believe, today. So welcome to the show, Carl Frio.
Dorian, thank you very much. Delighted to be talking to you today.
Fantastic. So just a little bit of background on the company and on Cod Hall. So Cod Hall was named the 2020 Ernest Young, or one of the 2020 Ernest Young's Entrepreneur of the Year finalists for his work with Open Orphan and hVIVO, and as the founder and managing director of Raglan Capital, which has continued a successful streak of IPOs with Open Orphan and with Emirate Pharma. Open Orphan was founded in 2017 with the aim of becoming a leading specialty CRO service. In 2019, Open Orphan acquired AIM-listed Venn Life Sciences, and in January 2020, it completed the merger with hVIVO. Open Orphan is primarily a CRO-based service. However, in recent years, its subsidiary, hVIVO, developed a number of vaccine and pharmaceutical products, primarily through its Immutex joint venture. hVIVO funded this along with Seed Group, and today it holds 49% stake in Immutex. Open Orphan is recognized globally as a leader in vaccine and antivirals development and is a top 10 European CRO. The company was profitable in Q4, very relevant given the company's relatively short history, although its subsidiaries have a much longer history and are quite well established in the field. And we'll get into a lot more detail on that. Now, Carl, you have quite an eclectic background. There's a little bit of information about your background on the Open Orphan website, and you've done a couple of previous interviews talking a little bit about your very hard work ethic going back to when you were in your teens. And this is something I definitely wanted to bring up again in this interview. I wonder if you can take us through that, you know, because your background includes a number of years as a lecturer. You also started and listed a couple of companies, including an oil and gas company, and then you shifted over into the life sciences, or you've been involved at least in life sciences for a number of years through Amrit. But I wonder if you can take us through those earlier experiences and, you know, how you ended up in the life sciences sector.
Yeah, Dorian, I think probably my wife sums it up properly. She's, God, you've got an attention span of a gnat. So that's probably, is that good or bad? But no, I think my core skill, Dorian, is that being able to read into a new space. I'm 56 and be forever hungry. But more importantly, I think maybe Joe Biden said it as well once, be forever curious. Curiosity is a great thing. So I've gone from finance to software to lecturing to oil and gas to pharma. But there is a theme. There are new sectors. There are sectors who influence our daily life. And a lot of times, for instance, this glass of water I'm drinking here, I remember many years ago, where does the glass come from? And I Googled it and realized it was silica sand that they get in Morocco. And they heated up an electric furnace to 1,023 degrees centigrade. And then suddenly you've got glass. So I think to go from that eclectic background, but we would say the theme is oil and gas exploration and drug exploration are basically the exact same processes. Both are dominated by 20 large players, oil and gas, Total, Exxon, Shell, those people, 20 of them. Pharma, exact same, 20 big ones, Novartis, Pfizer, GSK. And they drive the top of the tree. What both of them are useless at, and it's terrible thing to say, at discovery. Oil and gas companies can't discover oil. Pharma can't discover new molecules. But what they're wonderful at is, when it's discovered, is production and sales. Oil and gas companies can bring it out of the ground, produce it and sell it. Guess what pharma do? They can produce it really well and sell it. Look, for instance, BioNTech and Pfizer. BioNTech found the cure or the vaccine, but they're not very good. So, correction, I'll say that. They got Pfizer to make it and deliver it. Likewise, so in this COVID-19, you've got the little biotechs who will find it, and then the big pharma will. So that's the similarity I found between how it was almost a relative easy transfer from Facet Oil and Gas PLC and moving into the life science.
You mentioned a lot of really interesting points, especially the focus on building and growing these companies and similarities in the process between oil and gas. I hadn't actually thought about that too much, but I mean, coming from a pharma and healthcare background, I can definitely attest to the differences, different roles that biotechs play, discovery, early development versus a big pharma company sort of taking it to market and expanding and commercializing products. So interesting parallels there. In terms of the name Open Orphan, obviously the name implies orphan as in orphan drugs, orphan therapeutic areas. Is that part of the idea behind Open Ocean?
Yeah, like during like all things, when you start here, you don't end up, you don't know where we'll end up in life. And like that, the Open Orphan name comes from opening European markets for orphan drugs, very simply. Look at our logo, it's a map of Europe and North Africa. And then we've highlighted in yellow the areas which is mainly the EU countries. And why did we set up a company that was going to open European markets for orphan drugs? Well, it goes back to our previous company, Amrit Pharma. My colleague Ian O'Connell set that up, co-founded it. And that was very much focused on discovery and development of orphan drugs. We set it up 2014-15, found a great management team, got them going. And then we realized too many, let's say, bulls in the china shop. Mike, so the two guys we got had been out of a job for a year. That was Joe Wiley and Rory Nealon. We thought, well, you know what? These two guys can do a really good job. We think we could start again. And we realized, because that was taking real, Amrit had real pharmaceutical products, orphan drugs, and they were primarily sourced in North America and taking them into Europe. So we thought we'd set up Open Orphan, and the role would be we'd go to North America and we'd act as a consultancy business. We'd buy up a number of European small pharma services companies and we'd help bring in orphan drugs, because there's an awful lot more. There's over 2,500 orphan drugs either in the approval or in the clinic process in North America. There's less than 500 in Europe. So there's an opportunity. However, like all good opportunities, we headed down that road. We tripped over a struggling little life science company called Venn. It was a kind of early stage CRO. It was in difficulty. We'd say we liked it. We bought a stake and we did our IPO by a reverse takeover. That's the strategy that's on the NASDAQ. It's on the North American Europe. And a reverse takeover is you basically bid for a small, struggling, publicly listed company and you change the name, it acquires your company. So Open Orphan took over Venn and we listed. So Venn, instead of doing orphan drugs, we then had a nice clinical trials company based out of Paris and Breda outside Amsterdam. So that's, we did almost the pivot the day we did the IPO. And then we bolted on more. And we've very little to do with orphan drugs, but we're really happy with the day, the world leader in the testing of vaccines, antivirals and monoclonium using human challenge study clinical trials.
Okay, so not directly related to the orphan drugs, but certainly in the ballpark, and I guess part of the overall vision, I would say, at least it sounds like that. So really interesting stuff. Okay, you mentioned a couple points that I definitely wanted to dive into in this conversation, and one of those is you know, in the investor deck, even in the most recent one, I believe. Obviously, a couple slides right up front. You have the management team, and it sounds like you have a working relationship with at least one or two of them. How did you bring together the rest of the management team? And I'm also curious, you know, what sort of qualities or experiences do you look for when you were building out an Open Orphan's management team?
Good question. The common theme in this company, Open Orphan, and the previous one, Amrit Pharma, would be Ian O'Connell and myself. We work together, but we also have a, let's say, the mentor, or we call him Yoda, and his name is Professor Brendan Buckley. Brendan is a physician, but he was also the CMO, Chief Medical Advisor, on ICON for 7 years. So he's written several books on clinical trials. So Brendan helped us when we put Amrit together day one. He showed us how to reposition or repurpose a wound healing product and make it an orphan drug. Brendan would have co-authored European orphan drug protocols, and he was an advisor to the FDA. So myself and Ian wouldn't have the depth and understanding of the pharmaceutical industry, but we have Brendan, he's almost our master Yoda, and he keeps us in the straight and even. And yeah, he's brilliant. So that's where we have the deep. And like Brendan has been on, I think, more ethics panels than anybody else in Europe. He's taken more products through the clinic than people in Europe. So there, that's the brains of the operation, Ian and I would say.
The Master Yoda, is that an official role or is that just a nice kind of nickname for him?
I think he would be almost Master Yoda. He keeps an eye on us, and when we run into difficult problems, Brendan's only a phone call away.
Yeah, it's a great panel. I got to say, really, really solid management team there. I was really impressed when I was taking a look at the deck. Open Orphan, bit of a tongue twister. It's received a lot of public attention. You mentioned this also in the deck, something like, you know, over 10,000 media articles and press releases and rightfully so. And again, this is also impressive because the company hasn't been around too long officially anyways, Open Orphan as the umbrella company, the holdings company. A lot of the attention in the last couple of months, certainly since COVID really began, has been around COVID-19 trials, human challenge studies. The ramping up kind of, I should go this way maybe, has been exponential in media coverage and successes in winning contracts and in establishing partnerships as well. It's actually resulted in about a 10x growth in market cap over about a two-year period, roughly speaking. It's fantastic growth. I mean, you really don't see that sort of thing. I'm not sure if it qualifies for a unicorn, but I'd say it's pretty close. And it's obviously extremely exciting times, and especially going forward with some of the plans that we'll get into in this talk. You know, what do you find most exciting about working at Open Orphan, aside from this awesome growth?
Well, look, I think you probably answered it yourself. The unicorn image, status, and it's not even status, the goal. And going back to Amrit, myself and Ian still remain as significant shareholders in that. We haven't touched the shares, we haven't sold virtually. But Amrit was basically, let's be honest, 6 years ago was a little busted oil and gas company called Facet Oil and Gas. We changed the name, we saved the cash. And today Amrit is bouncing off from an enterprise value of probably $700-800 million. It's got a market cap of about $500 million. It's got $200-300 million in bonds. So the EV is pretty close to $1 billion. And then we flick over to Open Orphan and we put it together. It had a market cap of $10 million. Today, market cap well north of $200 million and rising. And we have a couple of, non-core assets going to spin off. And one of them in particular, we believe we can dual list it in NASDAQ and easily get a $300-400 million. So it's kind of fun of the game. It's almost as they say about romance, half the fun is in the chase. And we're very lucky, Ian and I, we've been very perfectly honest. A lot of people don't think we're quite funny, even over the last 3 months. We live quite frugal lifestyles. We live in very modest houses. We drive very old cars. But that has a reason. It means we don't have to take out huge salaries. And we end up putting a good bit of our personal cash. We put a lot of cash into Start Armored. We put a lot of personal cash into Open Orphan. So that means we retain a decent shareholding. And by the fact we've got, let's say, relatively frugal lifestyles, we can reinvest more as we start these ventures. So the thrill of the chase of doing it, trying to prove it, look, being honest with you, people thought Ian and I, we just got lucky with Amrit, we found two great guys. But we've kind of getting lucky again, and we think the plan would be we've now opened off the trajectory. Okay, it's a couple of £100 million market cap. We think between it and the spin-offs, can we get it to $1 billion enterprise value or market cap in the next 12 or 18 months? So that's a bit of fun to go there and see. If we fail, we'll probably get halfway there, but $500 million is pretty good fail.
Not bad at all. That is a pretty ambitious goal. But you guys are on the right track. I mean, it really looks that way. And every single time, I hear another kind of press release and another news update from the investment team, you know, that market cap is increasing. It's increasing quite well. So, we'll get into a lot more about the pipeline and what that's going to look like over the next couple months. Since you mentioned Amrit, I mentioned Raglan Capital from the start, Open Orphan, and a few of its subsidiaries. You know, I need to ask, how do you balance your day? What's your schedule like on a day-to-day, if you even have like a day-to-day type schedule?
Well, no, actually quite simple. And the Raglan Capital piece, that's almost like, that was our old original corporate finance business when we had a bunch of corporate finance people. We'd do M&A activity. That's wound down now completely. That's just our family holding vehicle. Our Amrit stake is held in there, our Open Orphan stake held in there. And then any surplus cash for investments, we keep it. And that goes back to, rather than buying the big houses, buying the yacht and buying the cars, we just leave the money in Raglan. So it allows us to reinvest. So day-to-day activities in Amrit is zero because there's a brilliant management team there. We retain a founder's position, decent shareholding. So we have no involvement there, which is great. And sometimes I say too many balls, like it's very clear. I'm quite a strong-willed person. And we found a great strong-willed CEO. So you kind of have two strong-willed CEOs in the same house. So Amrit, good hands, great guys. And then we came to Open Orphan. Basically, that's a full-time job. And then in between, Raglan is literally, you could say it's like a family office holding vehicle for a stake. So the full-time job is here in the office in London. Even though I reside most of the time in Dublin for the last year through the pandemic, because we're essential key workers, we're allowed to travel. I would come to London Mondays until Thursday night, although since January it got prolifically busy. And my wife is originally from Vienna, Austria, and then she decided home studying, she could take the kids to Vienna. And I said, January 1st, I'd decamp and stay in London for 3 or 4 months just to get it through this, we believe, critical inflection point. So, no, the day job is good. It's basically with the teams here in London, with 3 clinics, and it's being hand-on in the office every day, and that's it.
You mentioned kind of living frugally a couple times, and also you're driving an older car. I'm a huge car fan. I'm really curious what you're driving these days.
Well, okay, it's a BMW X6, but it's 11 years old. So.
Okay. Still a nice car. It's a good generation.
A good nice car.
Yeah, a good nice old car. All right, awesome. Wanted to shift over into Open Orphan's core businesses, services, and also products and offerings, and non-core offerings as well. Before getting to some of the nitty-gritty there, you know, kind of a broad question here, but I'm curious, since we've had a lot of talk around, you know, delivery of vaccines around the world, and, you know, everyone's got a more and more optimistic sort of outlook for what that means in the near future, especially for 2021. But, you know, is there a critical mass, do you think, that we need to hit in terms of vaccinating the population before we can really sort of go back to our normal lives? You know, people have said something like 60-70% of the population in that ballpark. But, you know, is that does that sound sort of realistic? And that, practically, what does that mean from a supply chain perspective? Or do we have enough doses?
I think they're joining forces. They should qualify. I'm not probably the best person to answer that, but I'll have a go. Okay. I'm not a scientist, but I think we have a lot of scientists working for us. So I think, perfectly honest, the pandemic is over, period. That's much, because as follows, the vaccines are being rolled out. Nobody ever really thought an mRNA vaccine would work really well. They're at 90%+ efficiency. Now you have the J&J, single shot, 90%+ efficiency. So the big worry 12 months ago when this kicked off, will the vaccine be available? Now we know they are. So I got all our staff here in London got vaccinated. The British government, because of Brexit, set up the vaccine task force. They have now vaccinated, I think, about a third of the population. I think it's past 25 million people today. They're just rolling it out. And if you look at the number of people around the world who got vaccinated, I think at the moment it's twitching somewhere north of 150 million. Not a single person in the world who got vaccinated during the trials or this world have got seriously ill or gone to hospital. So that tells you, oh, get the vaccine, you won't go to hospital, you won't get seriously ill. So to answer your question, my take is COVID-19 is going to be with us for a long time. But it very quickly, late this year, as soon as 30-40% of the populations get vaccinated, the hospitalization drops off a cliff, the death rates drops off a cliff, and it's over. The problem is, it's going to be around, but it's become then almost, it goes from pandemic to kind of regional epidemic. As what's that? That's the annual flu season. So going forward, we'll be all told, if we're worried, take your annual flu vaccine, and when you're at it, take your annual COVID vaccine. So I think once, and if you think going to statistics, so there's different stats, but about 90%, and I'm open for correction, 90% of all hospitalizations and deaths, COVID-19 around the world, are in excess of 70 years old and have 2 comorbidities. And I'm going to be very bold, and I'll probably get in trouble with this, but one of those comorbidities in every instance is obesity. And then, so people who are over 70 and have one of those, have at least are obese and another comorbidity, if they take the vaccine, which I think those people will absolutely do, they're not going to hospital, they're not going to die. So to answer your question, this herd, we've never managed to get herd for influenza, because influenza mutates and changes. Coronavirus is a 7 of them, OC43, 229E, SARS, MARS, and a couple of them. They're very predictable. They don't mutate too rapidly. This one is mutating a little bit quicker because it's gone around the world. But the thing is, the other 6 coronaviruses have never done anything crazy. They've never gone dangerously mutated. They've always got softer and weaker. So the reason I say pandemic is over, they'll roll out the vaccines. And the reason we're frightened in this pandemic, people were going to hospital, people were getting sick, and people were dying. But guess what? 90% of those were over 70, had 2 comorbidities. Vaccinate that, 90% of the issue is over. Does that kind of answer where I'm coming from?
It does. Absolutely. I also wanted to point out a bit of a distinction, but a lot of the news also tends to talk about the pandemic in terms of like the after effects, you know, job loss, economic impact, mental health impact, and that sort of thing. And there've been news releases talking about how that's going to have a very long-term effect on the population globally as well. The vaccine, huge progress. Looks like we're gonna be in a very good position this year, so that's definitely a positive. And there are also going to be these long-term effects outside of the media virus itself.
I think, sorry to jump in, Dorian, another part before we move on. There has been quite an outbreak in parts of Japan, in parts of Korea, and there's been a lot of COVID in South Africa and all of Africa. And my belief is, why is Korea, Japan, Africa, and even India, the death rate in the hospitalization is tiny for two reasons. They're not old. Japan slightly, we would say. Korea in particular, but Africa, they're much younger. But also, generally, Koreans, Japanese, Indians, and Africans are vastly skinnier. So I have this belief that this is a virus that does attack, like, say, more so the healthy, well-off Western countries where there's much older people. And I'll be more politically correct, say, and they've got two comorbidities. So that's where I think the pandemic is over. People are real. And those, the great part, older people will take the vaccine and people with two comorbidities. So that wipes the 90% out.
I'll let that point linger for a little bit. We also mentioned the virus variants as well. Vaccine distribution is staggered around the world. Not everyone sort of gets it at the same time. That's a supply chain thing as much as it is an access related issue. There's got to be a role to play for viral variants sort of popping up over the next couple of years. I imagine this is probably going to happen, especially in regions that won't be vaccinated right away. Does Open Orphan have a role to play in sort of protecting that or offering solutions sort of proactively for the anticipation of new viral variants sort of coming up over the next couple of years?
Absolutely. The Open Orphan's core skill is testing viruses, antivirals, in a human challenge. And the human challenge is you bring the volunteers in, 100 into quarantine clinic. 50% will get a placebo, 50% will get the active vaccine you're testing. But in that quarantine year, 100% will get infected with a challenge agent. If it's influenza, we will guarantee 100% that we'll get sick with influenza. If it's RSV, we're doing lots of that at the moment, 100%. And in COVID, we will be infecting 100% of our volunteers with COVID-19, the real deal. But the beauty about that model, we all know COVID is mutating. That's the word, the fear word. The real word is variant. You've got the Kent variation in the UK. You have the South African variation. You have the Brazilian variation. And going forward, you've had the big phase threes. We believe it's going to be more difficult to do a really fast phase three because the more vulnerable people, that group that comprises 90% of the hospitalization will be vaccinated. So it'll be very hard to do a phase three. But the UK regulator just last week, MHRA, announced that it will accept a human challenge COVID study as part of the approval process now for the variation. And I think the beauty about the, just because the vaccination hasn't gone around the world, it's almost like a fireman, the fire hoses in America and Europe, they're putting out the fire when people are getting very sick and dying. Look, the developed world, it doesn't appear to be as big a problem as the Western world because it goes back to the lifestyle and the older population. But what's going to happen every 6-12 months, I gather most of the big vaccine companies who have a COVID-19 vaccine are already working on the next variation. And if you think about it, every winter, we get a new. Last year, there was four different viruses in the common cold or the influenza. The previous year, there was three. So I think by the time we get into this winter, many of the big pharma companies will have a new variation. And the beauty of mRNA is only a small tweak to tick in. And that's why I think the mRNA platform is transformational for treating pandemics going forward. So the variations don't worry me. And I think using our human challenge, it's the ideal way for very quickly take the existing vaccine, take a new one, test one against the other against variation, and literally we can do in a human challenge in 2 months, but generally takes 2 years in the community.
Real, real interesting stuff. I should also mention too that human challenge studies, this very unique design, It's been around for a while. This is not a brand new thing, but this is the first time that it's being tested for COVID-19. Props to Open Orphan for initiating that and being first to be able to do that. And we'll get into a lot more detail about how that's actually going to work. I wanted to take this chance to dive into the company structure, Open Orphan's company structure, because again, it's really interesting and I think quite unique as well. It has, so we've mentioned hVIVO, we mentioned Venn Life Sciences, two major parts of the business. It also has a couple non-core assets. And you also have clinic spaces. I believe there's three now, and maybe there's more to come as well. Really, really interesting setup. I wonder if you can take us through that. What was the thinking process and how did it kind of get built up?
Yeah, look, my past history was a finance. One career I started more than 5 years, it was finance, M&A. So Amrit designs an M&A vehicle. All our assets came through acquisitions, usually distressed assets, because sometimes find it's easier to fix a distressed asset well and start from square one. Open Orphan was designed, we would roll it out day one. We said it was going to be an orphan drug acquisition vehicle. We're going to acquire companies. Turns out we pivoted, like all good, instead into the CRO business. But it is an acquisition vehicle. So the top co in the public markets knows this is Open Orphan PLC, our ticker's ORPH. And that's listed at the London Stock Exchange and the European Euronext Exchange. And we do that because we have an Irish office as well. But under that, we've acquired Venn, and then we've acquired hVIVO. And we probably acquire one or two more vehicles at customer. But again, the benefit of being an M&A guy for 15 years, and the benefit of Master Yodai, Brendan, who is involved in Icon acquired one company every year for the last 20 years. And including, we saw 2 weeks ago, Icon, the only 12,000 employees, and they acquired PRA for 9.6 billion and another 10,000 employees. But what Icon do is all big M&A, everything gets rebranded Icon. And not saying that's good or bad, but our model is slightly different. We will keep public markets will know as Open Orphan, but at customer level, they know hVIVO, gone back for 25, 30 years at customer level. So we retain the branding at customer level. Employees quite like retaining their email address as well. So our Venn staff continue to use Venn, hVIVO, because we engage. So the structure is whole code at the top, Open Orphan, that's where the funds are, we generate the cash, and that's how we speak to the public markets, and that's where we do a lot of international branding. But at customer facing, if you ask Pfizer, GSK, Novartis, who's Open Orphan, don't know. But if you ask them, who's hVIVO? Oh yeah, the human challenge guys. Then in Venn, if you ask some of our French, Servier, Ipsen, DNGI, Janssen, who's Open Orphan? Don't know. But who's Venn? Oh, Venn's are, they do our phase one, they do biometry. So the structure, to answer your question, Jordan, is as simple as an acquisition vehicle. But the trick is, and I've spent a lot of time, so I've spent time on the ground here with the staff in London, is getting the staff to know it's one company, which is Open Orphan, and three offices, a London office, a Dutch office, Breda, and a Paris office. And we work as one, and we just use the company facing branding for the customers, but we're all Open Orphan. Does that answer your question?
It does, yeah. And hVIVO, I think, has gone maybe more media attention than Venn, rightfully so, I would argue, at least for now. But I'm a little bit curious to dive into how Venn works. And like you mentioned, both of these have been around for a while now. If I remember correctly, I think I read somewhere like hVIVO's done something north of 500 studies through his history. So it's quite well established, quite well known. Venn, not as much media attention, but I'm wondering, you know, how does Venn work? And also, I'm curious too, are there synergies between hVIVO and Venn, or is that part of the plan?
Yeah, look, there's fabulous synergies between Venn and hVIVO as follows. A human challenge study is basically a 2A clinical trial. And for all clinical trials, you need data management and biostats. Traditionally, in the past, hVIVO would contract that out to a biostats company. Our Venn office in Paris have been experts, come back for 30 years in data management biostats. They would serve Ipsen, Servier, all the French big pharma. So they've been doing that for about 30 years. So now going forward, as part of Open Orphan, about 50% of the Venn office revenues, i.e. the biostats and data management, will be servicing the Open Orphan challenge studies at the London office. We then, Venn has a second office in Breda in Amsterdam. Instead of doing biometry, i.e. biostats and data management, the Venn office there, again, that was an acquisition, many years ago, 20 years ago, and it is a preclinical. It also does CMC, that's chemistry, manufacturing control, and it also does PK consulting. They would actually be the sole provider to the top, one of the top three German pharmaceutical companies. All of this PK work is contracted to Venn and Breda. So we have a really brilliant team there. To be frank, there'd be less overlap and synergy between the Venn office and the London office. And the London office, being honest, is the driver. We would do 10 times the revenue in challenge studies as we do with Venn. But it's still, so 50% of the Paris office revenues would be servicing London. And the Breda office is probably 5 to 10%, but growing, because for any challenge study, it's usually a big pharma and they're developing the vaccine and they'll want to look at a lot of PK analysis, i.e. what happens when you put the drug into pharmacokinetics in the body. So then get, sometimes they actually will see there's a challenge study and hence to us, and also CMC. So there's definite synergy together between the three of us, the three offices.
Are there any existing customers, clients that have ongoing contracts, let's say between both hVIVO and Venn Life Sciences?
Traditionally, believe it or not, yeah, there would have been quite, both companies would have known each other because both have a history in virology. Both of them would have been done a lot of vaccine development service and work, so they've known each other. But the London office, hVIVO, would have been very much challenge studies, and occasionally they've been working. But now where we have them, because they were all the one company, we acted just as three offices. We do rotate the staff between them. Pre-pandemic, they're getting ready to go at the moment with staff actually in the office from both Holland and Belgium this week, and have gone back. So one of the benefits of being key workers, because we're involved in vaccine developments, every staff member is tested twice a week. We all self-test at home at lateral flows. So we are within Europe. If you're involved in clinical trials, we do have an exemption. We can travel, provided for work.
Not as much traveling nowadays, but I imagine that it's could be a pretty fun time to get a chance to travel between the three offices under normal circumstances. Sounds pretty cool. I want to zoom in on challenge studies. You mentioned them quite a bit now. Again, they've been around for a number of years. Much more efficient design than traditional studies. Probably a lot more cost saving as well. Most interestingly, I think for me in these times is that, again, Open Orphan is the first to recruit to initiate a challenge study for COVID-19. So I wanted to just dive into that in terms of, you know, what are some of the study objectives and how the study was actually set up, and also how you're able to tap into your quarantine clinics, one of which is the Whitechapel Clinic. I thought I'd mention that because of a very unique characteristic about it, which is that it's a converted boutique hotel. Thought that was a nice little trick that you guys used. So let's see if we can dive into that a little bit. So what are some of the objectives and how was this study kind of set up?
Yeah, look, sort of challenge studies goes back quite a long time, but primarily where they really got going was 1947. And what happened in 1947 is the British government decided after World War II, they did a bit of soul search and said, you know what, influenza killed more Allied soldiers in World War II than the other people. And again, they thought World War I, actually the Spanish flu and influenza actually killed more people again. So 1947, as the soldiers demobbed after World War II, there was a large army base down in Salisbury Down, outside of London. And the government set up what's called, known as the Salisbury Common Clue Clinic. And that started the first proper commercial challenge studies. So the British government had been testing, trying to find the cure for influenza. I say influenza is tricky, a tricky little virus. They didn't find a cure, but for right through the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the Salisbury Flu Clinic had a lot of developments in finding cures for the common cold. It was called the common cold. Then in the late 80s, the government shut it down, and the remainder of staff, mainly under a guy called Professor John Oxford, left and set up a company in 89 called RetroScreen. And RetroScreen changed its name 10 years ago to hVIVO. So really our lineage goes back to the first proper commercial challenge studies in 1947 in Salisbury. So we have a lot of history in it. It never escaped from being honestly a kind of niche activity. Challenge studies has never up until recently become part of the regulatory approval package. Does the FDA, does the EMA accept them? Does the Japanese regulatory approval? They don't. But that, we believe, is changing. But where they fit it in is particularly a lot of our work at the moment. We'd have three large pharmas in the top five in the world in particular areas. They're about to commit a 100 million phase three study. And they come to us and say, look, can you do a really quickie 2A in this indication, get 100 volunteers, and we charge them basically £4 million for that. And we're going to do a very quickie on this. And the results we will give them, it'll take us 3 months, will guide, direct, and influence that 100 million study. And it might save them spending 100 million, spend 4 million with us. We will guide efficacy, certain safety symbols, and it takes us 2-3 months maximum. So that's where the human challenge study, because we can replicate life in the community with 100 volunteers that these big pharma would normally put 40, 50,000 volunteers. However, I would add, in the last couple of years, the EMA, FDA, sometimes are much more innovative. The EMA have decided they will accept a challenge study in some of them as a pivotal, which is basically proof that it works. And then, I'm very bold. I bought an Irish passport, a British passport. So today I'm a very much all British boy and very proud. But it is great being in Britain. They've spent the last couple of years beating themselves up, over Brexit. But if there wasn't Brexit, there wouldn't be the UK Vaccine Task Force. If there wasn't Brexit, Britain wouldn't have a third of its population vaccinated. But out of that as well, the UK regulator, which is no longer part of the EMA, is the MHRA. And just last week, they announced, actually, back to your earlier questions, for the new variations or the new mutations, viruses, or vaccines to cure them, we will accept a challenge study. So the challenge study has gone from being this relatively niche, obscure activity that maybe helped guide a phase three to now part of the package, and it's becoming more important. I think part of that as well, we were one of the few commercial providers, and being honest with you, the previous management, a challenge study might have been 8, 9, 10 million, and it would have taken 4, 5, 6, 7 months. We've built the model as the EasyJet model. I always saw the old challenge study was like with a British Airway first class ticket, very expensive, you traveled a long way. The modern challenge study is the EasyJet or the Southwestern Airlines, anyway. It's quick, cheap, and efficient. Does what it says does. So our standard challenge study now is a 4 million study. Sign it today, we'll give you data in 3 months. That's the future. And now suddenly the regulator said, no, oh, this is really interesting, particularly in pandemic. Does that kind of give you a whistle-top tour of where they came and how we became here today on challenge studies?
Absolutely, yeah. You know what? I hadn't realized that the regulators were not considering it as part of the regulatory package. Have they issued guidelines specifically for how to incorporate human challenge studies into their decision-making process?
A lot of the regulators, and we say the three, FDA, EMA, and the Japanese regulator, and our friends in China, the Chinese CDE, would have always looked at challenge studies as being really interesting. The supporting evidence is very useful, but it was never, I know some of my colleagues will slap me for this, but it's true, the FDA never accepted a human challenge as a formal part of the regulatory pathway. Is it phase one? Is it phase two? Is it phase three? It would have assisted. And many companies needed it to prove out a good, it's a phase 2A basically. However, the WHO indicated at the middle of the pandemic, say, well, and this got going, say, you know what? A human challenge study is going to be a really important part of rapidly developing vaccines. And now the MHRA in Britain, and I think the US FDA, Dr. Fauci, rightly or wrongly, says he thinks, no, we'll leave that to our British friends. You can take the chances. But the beauty thing about it, he's left us to pioneer it. And I think the British now are saying, wow, so I would be very surprised if you don't see human challenge programs being rolled out around the world in the coming 12 months by different regulators saying, wow, the British have done it. It worked pretty well. That's pretty exciting. And that we need a slice of that action.
And Open Orphan is paving the way for that. Really interesting stuff. And again, the implications for long-term implications for this kind of thing, not only for Open Orphan as a company, but for, you know, other vaccines and other drugs as well. Pretty huge. So that's really awesome news, actually. Coming back to the COVID-19 challenge study that was initiated, I believe, in January of this year?
Correct.
Okay. The recruitment goal is 90 participants. I'm not sure if the first one has been recruited just yet, but it's well underway. And I wonder if you can, again, just take us through some of the details in terms of how this will unfold over the next couple of months.
Yeah, look, our current COVID-19 human challenge program started on 7th of March last year. And our scientific team COVID-19 was called the coronavirus. It wasn't even called COVID-19. It's the 7th of March. We, our team in your lab, had been working for the previous 2 years on a seasonal coronavirus challenge study model. Went to a lot of big pharma. I would say, you know who you are, the big pharma, and said, look, we think coronaviruses could cause a problem. And they genuinely got laughed at. No, kids, we've got coronaviruses. There's six of them. They're harmless. They're SARS and MERS are deadly. They stayed in Asia. They stayed in Saudi Arabia. OC43, 229, they're harmless. We all got a bit of that in this. Like you or me, one-fifth of the population have a coronavirus called OC43 or 229. Anyway, the team had been working on, and then could get nobody to buy it. They said, no, coronavirus is totally harmless. They're not going to cause a pandemic. Boom, bang, coronavirus pandemic kicks off. 7th of March, we said, right, we've got a challenge study nearly ready to go. We announced it. 7th of March, that was the most publicized press release in the world. It was picked up by RV News organizing because we were going to infect people with coronavirus. Sensational news. We worked on it over the summer. Every big pharma company came and said, can we have a piece of that action? Except UK government gazumped them and got to us first and said, look, join us. We're part of a consortium called the Vaccine Task Force. Come together with us and we will work with you. And that's where we've ended up. It took quite some time because big pharma were doing their vaccines. And we worked through last summer into the autumn. And the serious part of doing challenge studies, you are deliberately infecting healthy humans. So you've got to take your time. We could have rushed out last summer, last autumn, we did, and we took our time. And to make sure we perfect the model and the amount of coronavirus we will give our volunteers, a bit like we do influenza, RSV, has to be just enough to show infectivity, but not enough to endanger life or to make it. And over since the last 30 years, we've never had a blue light instance of where we give some quite tricky viruses. So eventually, we got final regulatory approval. And in Britain, the real ultimate arbiter is not as MHRA, but like other, is the ethics panels. And we got approval on the 17th of February to proceed. We're doing it in the Royal Free Hospital. We have our own quarantine unit in Queen Mary's University Hospital. You know, that's where we are. It's 24 beds. We acquired a hotel across the road. In those facilities, we're primarily doing RSV, asthma challenge studies, RSV challenge studies. Because Corona, COVID's a bit more interesting, we're having it in the UK. The British government kindly provided the UK Infectious Disease Centre on the 11th floor of the Royal Free. That all our units have negative air pressure, but that has a particularly secure environment. That was when there was an Ebola outbreak in West Africa 3-4 years ago, and there was a lady, a nurse from Scotland, got infected, and she was taken back in the bubble. She was quarantined there for a number of weeks. So that's where we've got access to that, to run this initial study, which is before you do the challenge, you've got to do a characterization. A characterization is a small study, and you dose, it's like a phase one, it's dose loading. So we have to see how much of a tiny amount of the COVID-19 virus do we use that will get infectivity. Most cases, the volunteers won't even know they got it because we check it'll be on their viral load and PCR, simple PCR testing. As soon as we see infectivity, the shedding virus, we shut the process down.
Really awesome to hear about the human challenge study, again, focusing specifically on COVID-19. You guys are paving the way for across the entire market for that. I should also mention that that Open Orphan is running a number of studies related to COVID-19 related vaccines and other products. So really interesting to hear a lot more about that in the coming months. Part of that actually has to do with generating second gen vaccines, which we can have a whole conversation about separately. For now, what I really wanted to tease your brain about a little bit is this platform, which is one of Open Orphan's non-core assets, but super exciting from where I'm standing, and I'd love to hear a lot more about it. It's called the Disease in Motion platform. It's a patented analytics and data platform. Just in case anyone comes across the other name that I've read in other bits of news, Open Orphan Health Data. Essentially, this platform is an opportunity to build a database using retrospective data from existing studies from hVIVO's past studies, I believe. And you can please correct me if I'm off base there, as well as adding new data from participants that are going to be recruited prospectively in future studies. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and what are some of the applications of this data and analytics platform, and also how will it be rolled out to potential customers?
Yeah, Jordan, again, taking over, sometimes M&A guy, you take over a company and it all goes wrong, and sometimes it all goes right. HVAVO was almost like the little gold mine that keeps on giving. Now, pandemic helped us. When we took over HVAVO in January of last year, 12 months ago, it was bust. It had run out of cash. We did advance the payroll, pay the payroll in January. And people were saying, why do you want to take over the world leader to test the vaccines? Vaccines is Cinderella industry. When we know what happened 3 months later, vaccines suddenly were the hottest territory. So the rest is history there. However, within HVAVO, as I said earlier, they have been deliberately infecting healthy humans since 1989. Every time we run a challenge study, we infect on average 100 volunteers. 50% will have the control vaccine, 50% will have the placebo. The placebo group, we share the data because we, that's how the contracts work. So for instance, big pharma comes, they get all the data on the control arm. But we get to actually, believe it or not, so we've got samples in our freezers, going back to 89. And those samples are blood samples and nasal swabs. So we can see RVR for the 2 weeks in quarantine, what happens to the body, the blood oxygen level, the core body temperature, the viral load, all sorts of biomarkers from hours, days before infectivity, when you infect them, and then as they get well. So challenge study, you start here, you make them sick, they get ill, runny nose, sore throat, and then the shed virus, and then they come down the curve and send them home perfectly healthy 2 weeks later. So we've harvested all that data. So HVAVO today has the world's largest store of infectious disease. It's called infectious disease progression data. Hugely, we've got what's called a diary. Every volunteer, every twice a day, fills in a symptoms diary, how they feel, because it's, so we've got that data. HVAVO did know it would come invaluable someday. And we've been really lucky. We've now patented. Now we have to put our hands up. Uncle Sam, DARPA, the Defense Research Organization, also got a study, and they were using our work and left us data that, hypothetically, if a young Marine goes to warship, could we swab his saliva? Well, we know that is quite prophetic what we got involved in. If you think what happened to COVID when drew a battleship, would that Marine officer get seriously ill from influenza, less ill, or would be okay? So we've now biomarkers. If we took a saliva sample from any human, we can say, what's the chance of getting sick, really sick, or not sick at all? So the moment you get COVID, usually 90% of patients, your heartbeat, resting heartbeat, goes from 50 or 60 beats a minute, 50% uplift for not 1 day, not 2 days, 3 days. So the damage from long COVID is your heartbeat has been elevated by 50% for 3 solid days. So you've run 10 marathons, and then your heartbeat, as you fight off the infection for the 3 following days, goes 40% below. So you have this massive spike. So what I'm trying to say, we've got data and we're sharing them with pharma and wearables that your watch, provided we load the data up, it'll go ping, 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 and it'll say, Dorian, you look like you have influenza. Dorian, you look like it's common cold, or even better, you look like it's COVID-19. Now, it won't give you a diagnosis. It'll say, right, and I know Amazon and loads of people around, you really should go to your physician, or if it's only common cold, go to your Walgreens and take some painkillers. So disease in motion, we think, is even bigger than the entire company, because we have this data, it's been harvested, it's sitting secure, and we want to share it with big pharma, that if you want disease progression data, it's that simple thing. You're deliberately making somebody sick, and we know everything happens to them for the following 2 weeks.
You mentioned a lot of really interesting things. And again, I wish we could have a longer conversation just on this itself. But really quickly, before we get into the last question here on the future outlook of Open Orphan, the signal that you mentioned, is that has that been tested, let's say, in a head-to-head type comparison or anything kind of rigorous? And is there a white paper or anything published?
Even why the world is watching our study that we kicked off in, let's say, recent days, in the Royal Free Hospital, we can show the data now. We know we're coming to them, and it's infected through a spray and aerosol. And we can see exactly from the moment we spray the aerosol into the COVID volunteers, what happens, heartbeat, blood oxygen, all. So now for the problem in the past, it has been conjecture, people looking back, I think I got sick then, look at my heartbeat. It is, and this is actually where we're learning why COVID is quite unique. Does that make sense? So that's where it's really exciting. And that's what the beauty of the challenge study, you're in control, you infect the volunteer, and let's watch everything that happens. They're hooked up. We've got patches on them. We have everything. We take nasal swabs every hour. We take blood. But we've been doing that for 30 years.
Again, really interesting data set and platform you guys have. I can already imagine a couple applications, really interesting and exciting stuff, how it can be actually used in the real world to develop additional predictive algorithms or to help spot patients quite early. Really interesting stuff. Cathal, just maybe one final question here, because I know we have to wrap up fairly soon, unfortunately. For 2021, I believe the focus for Open Orphan is actually going to be a little bit less on acquisitions or raises, and a lot more on growing its contracting business, as well as monetizing its non-core assets, potentially to spinoffs and in other strategies as well. I've also heard you mention a little bit about your interest in hospital infections. So I'm wondering, you know, over the next year, 2021 specifically, and then a little further out, maybe 3 to 5 years, what do you envision for the company in terms of its growth and its activity?
Yeah, look, we're going during challenge studies, traditionally a respiratory disease, as most people think about them. However, what beyond COVID, and look, we've challenge studies for malarial infections, any viral infection. But what we haven't done before, nobody's done, is antimicrobial. And where is the nastiest microbe in the world? Is the hospital, antimicrobial, and there's a lot of beyond infection. So we're actually starting challenge studies to test efficacy against antimicrobial activities. We see that being a huge growth area. We think as well, separately, the world for 30 years has kind of ignored vaccine development, has kind of ignored antiviral development. The only real antiviral we've known is the Roche Tamiflu. It hasn't been really much more, and has certainly ignored the risk by a major bacterial infection, antimicrobial. So what we're in position, we think the world, Bill Gates was right. COVID, in our view, is over. The vaccines work. It's just going to take 6 or 9 months to work through the system. But as one pandemic is cured, most people thought, Spanish flu, they only come once every 100 years. Well, people, what happens if something else happens? So I think for the next 10 years, we're going to be really busy doing challenge studies for a host of, let's say, infectious diseases. So that's one. The other, we have non-core. We're a profitable services company. We shouldn't be developing products. So the non-core assets will be spun off. And being honest with you, the disease in motion, we think that could be a $1 billion company. And we should look at spinning that off, because we want big pharma to come and trust us. They want data. We'll find the data and we hand it back. Along the way, we do get joint ownership of the placebo data, but that's placebo data. There's no control in there. And then we'll spin that off into a disease in motion. But I think it would be a crime to keep that, the world's largest database, tucked under a cupboard here in London. The world needs to know what happens to infectious diseases. And as we've paid in the disease in motion, what happens when the disease starts moving? That's applicable to wearables, but it's actually probably more applicable to big pharma. Big pharma, we can almost offer them a petri dish. There's what happens when somebody gets influenza, or is V, COVID, and we have it back to 1989. So that's it. And the great thing, we put in the freezer, it stays.
Awesome. All really good news. I would also attest to this this sort of feeling, broadly speaking, that we're kind of over the initial COVID hump, although there's still a lot of recovery to get through and a lot more distribution to get through in terms of the vaccines. But I think a lot of people are a lot more conscious now of the need to prepare for the next pandemic. Because there, you know, there are a lot of things that we need to protect ourselves against. And again, Open Orphan seems to be in an awesome position to help from a global community perspective through what potentially might be to come. Cathal, awesome speaking with you today. I wish we had more time, really. This is a really enjoyable conversation. And, you know, I'd love to get you to come back at some point as more things are happening with Open Orphan and in the world as well. I'd love to get your perspectives on things going forward. Really enjoyed this again. Thanks so much for coming on today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I'd love to come back when we've got a more proper update on where we've got, when we've maybe completed our the world's first human challenge, when all our volunteers have walked out safely and gone home, and we've got real world data to share with everybody. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. All the best and take care.